We shall continue. Now, behavioral psychology uses some fairly specific terminology. And this is terminology that much of the rest of the world screws up entirely. This actually includes psychologists that are not out of the behavioral psychology background. We'll screw this up. But in terms of their outcomes and effects, when we use the term positive, we mean something is delivered. Negative means something is removed. A reinforcer is something that, all other things being equal, causes a behavior to increase, or, if we've already gone through some of the training, maintains a behavior at a high level. Okay? So basically, reinforcer causes an increase. A punisher causes a behavior to decrease. So all other things being equal causes a behavior to decrease, or, again, if we've gone through some of the training already, keeps the behavior at a low level, possibly so low as to not even occur at all. So when we talk about, when we use the terms reinforcer or punisher, this is just kind of a shorthand for the effect that something or other has on a behavior. So we say, oh yeah, that's a reinforcer, that's a punisher. What we're talking about here is what it does to a particular behavior. Does it increase behavior, decrease behavior? So positive, something's delivered. Negative, something's removed. Reinforcer, behavior increases. Punisher, behavior decreases. Putting those together, we got the four basic operant relations. Okay, there's just really just four of them. These guys are basic. Now, we can look at this in a slightly pictorial or graphical kind of way here. So on the top here of this little table, I've got, let's just call it response rate here. Let's imagine that we're going to do a little operant chamber thingy with rats, okay, to use as examples here. Okay, so our rat's response rate will either increase or decrease. And over on the side here, we've got responses causes the stimulus to be either, you know, something is either presented. Sorry, this doesn't mean the discriminative stimulus. It's just like a thing in the environment. Let's call it the outcome, sort of, okay? So causes something to be presented or something to be removed. Okay, it's not even necessarily the outcome. Okay, so just remember I said discriminative stimulus refers to that thing in the presence of this thing. If you do this response, then this will happen. But there's lots of other stimuli out there in the world. Okay? So that's why Skinner was big on specifying the discriminative stimulus. Let's go here. So, positive reinforcement. Remember, positive, something is presented, reinforcement, behavior increases. So let's say we've got a situation where we've got a hungry rat, and if the rat presses the lever, it will get some food. Over repeated learning trials, all other things being equal, we would expect that this lever pressing is going to increase. So the behavior will increase. Lever pressing will increase. So the response rate, it'll do it faster, it'll do it more, it'll do it longer, whatever. The lever pressing will increase. And why? Because something is delivered, it gets food. So something's delivered. Okay, so something being delivered is a positive behavior. Lever pressing increases reinforcement. Negative reinforcement. Negative, something's removed. Reinforcement, behavior increases. So let's say our rat is sitting there in the operant chamber and it's getting a shock. We're running a foot shock through the wire mesh floor. Bzzz, it's going, ooh, ah, ooh, ah, ooh, ah, ooh, ah. If it presses the lever, this stops the shock for 30 seconds. Okay? So something is removed. The shock is taken away. This causes the lever pressing behavior to increase. So shock removed, negative. Something's removed, behavior increases, reinforcement. Positive punishment. Positive, something is presented or delivered. Punishment, get a decrease in the behavior. If the rat presses the lever, it gets an electric shock. I wonder what this lever does. Whoa! That could have just been coincidence. Push lever. Whoa. Third time's a charm. Push. Okay. Done with that. Unless you have a rat hopped up on morphine or something, or, you know, the iron rat, it's probably going to, or if it's wearing insulated booties or something, it's probably going to stop pressing that lever fairly soon. Okay? So, positive, something's delivered, the shock, it's delivered, behavior decreases, punishment. Okay? Finally, negative punishment. Negative, something's removed, punishment, behavior decreases. With this one, need a little bit of a backstory. Let's assume that there's some food sitting there and on a little sort of plate, and there's maybe a couple of levers, a red lever and a green lever. If you press the green lever, a trap door opens and the food falls down into an incinerator. And you get this rat that has expression of, right? So press the green lever, trap door opens, food gone. So food is lost, food is taken away. Probably stop pressing the green lever pretty quickly. Okay, behavior decreases. So negative punishment. Or you hit your sister and you get a timeout. You're taken away from the fun thing. You have to stop being able to play. Okay, so timeouts are often seen as negative punishment. Okay, now, like I said, very specific terminology that behavioral psychologists, learning psychologists use here. Very commonly, lay people talk about punishers as being nasty, horrible, bad things, reinforcers being wonderful, good things. Good, bad. We tend to avoid that because those are value judgments. And what seems to be good or bad to one person may not be good or bad to another one. So we tend to use reinforcement. Punishment, we use positive and negative. Let's try an example. Let's see how well people have done with this. Child runs out into busy road. Child gets spanked. This is an example of, let's vote, positive reinforcement. Anybody? Okay, good. Negative reinforcement. Positive punishment. Okay. Negative punishment. Okay. None of the above, because there's still people that haven't voted. Okay. You're wrong. You're all stunningly, stunningly wrong. Correct answer was none of the above. Child runs into busy road. Child gets spanked. What's the outcome on the child's behavior? Does the child keep running into the busy road or not? We don't know. I didn't tell you. I just said we determine reinforcer punishment by its effect on behavior, not by what we think is a nice or a not nice event. I don't know what's going on. Yeah, maybe the kid's hopped up on morphine and can't feel a spanking. Hopefully not. Maybe the kid is so desperate for attention that he's doing dangerous stuff. Yeah, getting spanked hurts, but at least someone pays attention to the kid. If you give the child the attention of spanking, you've just given... If what the child is trying to get is attention, you have just actually reinforced this behavior. What might we predict is going to happen? The kid will keep running into the busy road or doing other dangerous things. We don't know what the motivations always are. What we can record is a behavior. We have to make inferences about what may or may not be going on inside. So you've got kids in a classroom setting that act up. They get sent to the principal's office. It just isn't, teacher's rule book says, teacher workbook says, in the event of child misbehaving, send child to principal's office. This will stop child misbehaving. It is the rule. It is the law. It will work. It doesn't always work. If the kid is desperate for attention from adults, send him to the principal's office, making the kid the focus of everybody in the class, making the teacher, principal, other teachers perhaps, and forcing parents to come in for a principal-parent meeting. You just reinforce that behavior. If the behavior isn't decreasing, you don't have a punisher. Conversely, if the behavior isn't increasing, you don't have a reinforcer. That's how we measure this. So that is, I don't ask trick questions. I will ask difficult questions or tricky questions, but not something that I would say is a trick question. Okay? I do know professors that will ask trick questions, and I think it's crap because I've been doing this longer probably than a few of you have been alive. If I can't manage to trick you, I don't actually know this material. I can trick you somehow. What does that tell me? Yay, I know more than you do. Well, no kidding. Of course I know more about this than you do. If I didn't, I shouldn't be standing up here, right? That's not the point of an exam. The point of an exam is to see what you actually know given what you have been exposed to. Now, with that question, it wasn't a trick question. I just gave you enough information to actually answer it. But you've had preconditioning. You've had prior learning. Right? The way we talk about punishers is, spanking is a punisher. That's the way common people speak. It's not the way the lofty profession of learning behavioral psychologists speak. We talk a different language here. Yeah? If child runs into busy street, child gets spanking, child no longer runs into busy street or misbehaves, that would be an effective positive punisher. Spanking is delivered, behavior decreases. Yep, so if it actually worked, if I told you the outcome, yay, positive punisher. If he does more stuff, it's like child now starts leaping off buildings and playing with explosives. It's like, we've just actually increased dangerous behavior somehow. It's gotten worse. So we've done a positive reinforcer. Okay. So important to keep these terms straight. And you need to know the outcome. Now, interestingly enough, can you guess which? I had a good friend of mine is a dog trainer. She's a very good dog trainer. I mean, she's worked down in California for years. She's from here. She worked down there. She's worked with police dogs, guard dogs, drug sniffing dogs, just dogs from like the stars of the Real Housewives of Orange County, not her most, proud moment, perhaps. I think she likes working with the guard dogs and police dogs more. But, so she's never specifically trained in learning behavior courses. She's all very applied stuff. But we talked to her and said, what techniques are you using with the dogs down in California? She says, we use positive reinforcement and negative reinforcement. It's like, okay, so do you not use, shock collars or anything? It's like, that's the negative reinforcement. So the dog does something we don't want, we give it a shock. That's not negative reinforcement. I say that's positive punishment. The shock is delivered, and does it cause the behavior decrease? They stop doing it. That's positive punishment. It's like, no, it's not. It's negative reinforcement. It's like, no, says I, that's positive punishment. Behavior decreases, something's delivered, the shock. It's like, just, oh, well, you know, technically, I suppose you're right. He's like, yeah, I know we're right. I'm a learning behavioral psychologist. We invented the freaking term. Of course I'm right. He says, well, yeah, but you don't want to tell people you're punishing their pet. So we say negative reinforcement. Because negative sounds like it's bad, right? So we use negative reinforcement. It's like, no, you don't. Well, we say that. I have to wear a night guard for my teeth because grinding here. So, yeah, this is what happened. People tend to confuse, lay public, even people that should know better, tend to confuse negative reinforcement and positive punishment. Right? So if you're good, if you do this thing, I'll give you a lollipop, positive reinforcement. If you're bad, I'll hit you with a stick. Negative reinforcement. No, that's positive punishment. Even other professors in psychology that don't come out of this area will screw these up. So, just keep them straight there. Okay. All right. Now, in terms of reinforcement, also for punishers as well, but we usually see this in terms of reinforcement. We can talk about different kinds. We can talk about primary or secondary. A primary reinforcer is something that is not dependent upon any sort of association being made with other reinforcers. So it just will increase behavior in and of itself. If the rat is hungry and you've got some food that the rat likes to eat, that will probably serve as a primary reinforcer. Similarly, punishers, right? We can talk about primary punishers as well. Something that in and of itself, typically a primary punisher is something that causes physiological pain, a body response of pain. Okay. There's various things that could be primary reinforcers. Secondary, also sometimes called conditioned reinforcers. These are some neutral stimulus, initially neutral stimulus, that gets paired with a primary reinforcer. So it gets associated. In and of itself, the neutral stimulus has no particular effect. So if I snap my fingers or beep, blow a whistle, in and of itself, that doesn't do anything to a dog. So let's say I'm training a dog, okay? I got a pocket full of meaty treats, okay? Trademark, meat treats. Okay, the dog... sit. Dog sits. Boom. Meaty treat. Primary reinforcer. If I have to keep doing this, I'm going to have a very fat dog. Right? If every time it's like sit and the dog does it. Or lay down and the dog does it. Or shake and the dog does it. Whatever it is. Very soon I've got a dog filled with meaty treats. So I can make an association here. Sit. The dog does it. Got the meaty treat and snap and give the dog the meaty treat. Sit, dog sits. Do them together. After doing this for a little bit, I can sort of withhold some of the primaries. Now it's just sit. And the dog's like, oh, I did it right. This works great with dogs, right? Because dogs are very social animals. The great thing with dogs, this is why I love working with dogs. Dogs are these pack animals. They have a hierarchy just like humans do. And the cool thing with dogs is dogs are really happy if they know where they fit in the pack hierarchy. They don't have to be the top dog. They don't have to be boss. All they really want is consistency. They want to know where they belong. All right? Kind of like kids, right? With human children. Human children sort of were very similar in some ways. Need to know where they belong. Is it the kid that's really going to be in charge of the house? Or is the adult in charge? You get into behavioral problems quite often. Not always, but quite often when there's ambiguity of the situation. Like dogs, had friends. I used to house sit for them. They used to have two Havanese. These are little Cuban circus dogs. It's like they're made out of rubber. These are bizarre little things. They can jump vertically, like about this high. Like this big. Sort of things just go. And so with my friends, I had these two dogs, Avro and Faraday, And Faraday was really the little shit disturber. Avro was kind of like, you know, I often think of them like you know the cartoon Pinky and the Brain? Right? Like you know, Avro was like, I don't know if we should really be doing this. Faraday's like, it'll be brilliant! I'll be in control! You see that turkey on the counter? I'm gonna get it! And poof, poof, onto the counter, eating the turkey, kind of. So they ate my friend's antique fedora hat. They destroyed a dozen beeswax candles. You know, what's the big deal? This too will pass through the dogs. They destroyed them in the carpeting. It's really hard to get melted wax and chewed up wax out of carpet. They peed and pooped on years over just about everything they could. Primarily Faraday. Because Faraday, for various reasons, was pretty concerned that he should be in charge. That he was the most dominant thing in the house. So I used to house sit for them sometimes. Before I was married, before I had kids, when I had time to do this sort of thing. And, you know, we had really different ways of dealing with the dogs. So, like, you know, I come in, I set down my bag that had my computer and clothes and stuff in it, and, like, Faraday's like, I see him doing this. He's heading immediately. I know what's going to happen. He's going to go scent mark, i.e. pee, all over my bag of stuff. And it's like, no! You grab him, flip him over on his back, pin him down by his throat, shake him a bit, growl in his face, pick him up, toss him into his little kennel, close the closet door on him, leave him there for an hour. That's so mean. Open the door. Dog comes out. We play. It's good. You know, then it's like, okay, I've made my sandwich. You know, I'm going to have lunch. And oh, forgot my drink. Go back. Faraday's heading for my sandwich. He's going to eat it. It's like, grab him, pin him down on the ground on his back, hold him by his throat, growl in his face, shake him a bit into the... Okay, what am I doing? I've gone insane, obviously. No, this is dog-related behavior. Dogs get this. If dogs get into a fight in a pack, what the winner does, grab them by the throat, and it's a submissive response. Okay, so they stop it. I became the most dominant dog bastard in the house. I mean, this is it. But what I could do then is after a few times of this with Faraday, you know, he'd go to do something, so it's like, ah, and it's like, oh. I'm just going over here to lay down. And we got on smashingly. It was wonderful. Great, but the problem is my friends wouldn't do this. It's like, oh, you just ate Hetty's antique fedora. Bad puppy. The dog's like, yeah, I'm great. Oh, yeah, you know, bitches, I'm going to just totally eat your candles next. I rule this house. And that was a problem for them. Okay, dogs are totally happy in a household if they know where they rank. Okay? They're great. If they rank below the kids, that's fine. They're good as long as it's consistent. If there's ambiguity, sometimes they're more important, sometimes they're less, it really blows their little noodle. It's like, oh, should I be trying to take over or not? Okay, so where this is going is a lot of your secondary conditioners come into play here. The way you act around not just dogs, but people come into play. We learn these kinds of stimuli. We tell things. Body language becomes hugely important. Interesting research with psychopaths shows that psychopaths will identify who to pick on based on, amongst other things, nonverbal body cues. So they learn this, what becomes a submissive posture. And they trust body language more than they do vocalization. So, interesting things there. But back to the dog and the treats. Once I've established a snap here as a conditioned reinforcer, secondary reinforcer, if I only give a meat treat every five or so times the dog does what I want, that's cool. That's fine. It's good at that. It's going to keep doing this. These become really important if, as well, I mean, what if the dogs, I'm training the dog to do retrieval. So it's got to run across the field and catch the frisbee, or you know, go bring the duck back, or do whatever. The dog's 150 yards away. It's like, catch the meat treat. No, that won't work. But if I blow on a whistle, I've just reinforced it. If I've set up a whistle as a secondary reinforcer. If you don't follow, so once you set up your three-term contingency, stimulus, response, outcome, if you don't provide that reinforcer, you will get into extinction, right? Just like in classical conditioning, if the CS is no longer followed, you know, associated with the US, you get into extinction. So, but if you can provide a secondary reinforcer, right? The dog's way off on the other side of the field bringing the Frisbee back or whatever. I need to reinforce it right when it gets there. Oh, got the Frisbee. If I have to wait for the dog to come back to me, you know, and then go, good boy, here's a meat treat. The dog's going, why did I just get this meat treat? Oh, because I'm standing here in front of it. Right? We talked about this, you know, like the long delay versus trace. Similar things from classical conditioning, right? The most contiguous things is like, I'm right here in front of you, which then gets hard if you're trying to train the dog to retrieve, because it's like, why would I ever leave? I get meat treats right when I sit here. It's like, go get the Frisbee. I should be going to feed me when I'm here. I'm here now. What are you messing with me for? Yeah. Secondaries, it's like 150 meters. Tweet. Dog's like, yes, score. Okay. So, primaries and secondaries. You can, as I say, punishers as well. We can talk about primary and secondary punishers as well. You know, stern looks can serve perhaps as a conditioned punisher. You don't actually have to go beat somebody or something. It's like, all right. So those can be conditioned too. All right. So they have a lot of names, secondary reinforcers, bridgers, clickers, whistles. Okay. Different groups call them different things. But this is the idea. Sometimes I call it bridge because the idea is supposed to bridge the period until you can get that primary reinforcer in there. Now, if you just tried to switch in time, so we've established a secondary reinforcer here. If you said, well, that's it, I don't need to provide primary reinforcers ever again, oops, no, we are going to get into extinction effects. Periodically, you need to give the secondary and a primary together. Periodically, you need to just strengthen that association there, okay? So once you've set up a secondary, you can't just end it. They're usually a bit weaker than primaries. Right? You know, the good boy for the dog or the whistle, you know. That's good. You know, but give him the meat treat and the dog's really going to be happy there. Plus side is they're really not prone to satiation. I mean, sooner or later, even with relatively small meat treats, the dog will fill up. Okay. But you can listen to whistles all day. When we work with things like rats, you know, in the lab, like I said, there's various things you can use for food reinforcers. Ames pellets. What's an Ames pellet? An Ames pellet is a teeny tiny little bit of rat chow about the size of like a ball bearing, small ball bearing, a BB. Size of like half a grain of rice. Okay, they're very, very small. So rats can eat like 100 of these things before their tummy gets full. I mentioned they really like, most rats really, not all, there's always the odd one, but most rats really like chocolate. So like the little tiny Baker's M&Ms, those are pretty good size. They can probably, you know, suck down 50 or 75 of those before they kind of start to go, oh, too much chocolate, oh, sort of thing. So those are, you know, small packages for your primaries. There's also what we call generalized reinforcers. These are secondary reinforcers that will work with lots of different situations. So if I'm doing the training with the dog, right, I pair the like a whistle with the little meat treat, and that pretty much the dog learns whistle means meat treat. Okay? Sort of stands in for the meat treat. And it probably stands in very specifically in a training kind of context. Generalized reinforcers or generalized secondary reinforcers will apply to all kinds of things. You can use them in lots of contexts. Can you think of one with people? What's a great generalized secondary reinforcer for humans? Even for you guys. Yeah, money, exactly. Money's brilliant, right? In and of itself, money has no intrinsic value whatsoever. as the Greeks are discovering right now. Very unfortunately for them. If you had a barter society, a chicken has an inherent value. You can eat a chicken. You can wear clothing. A euro has no actual value. A $20 Canadian bill, I mean, you can't eat it. Well, you can eat, you can actually eat it, but I mean, you're not going to get any food energy out of it. And in fact, actually, if you eat enough of them, you will kill yourself. You know that? The little holograms on the $20 bills are actually poisonous. When they first brought the little holograms in with these, someone said, but what if people eat them? Like, who would? It's like, I don't know, it's kids maybe. They eat pennies, which we're getting rid of as well. But not for that reason. So it's like, so they had to do a study. So they found that the LD50, the lethal dose to kill 50% of the rats, was you'd have to eat $80,000 worth of 20s. So it's pretty safe. You're probably not doing that. But of course, keep in mind, sample size, you know, you want to have probably at least 100 rats. So, you know, we're up into millions of dollars to do this study now because you have to feed them. That's good. Good use of our tax money. No, they didn't actually feed them the entire 20. They just took the little holograms and fed them and saw it. So, yeah, it's fairly simple. But, I mean, yeah, you can't survive on eating the money. You can't build, well, I mean, I guess you could build a house out of 20s, but you need a lot of them. You know, try building a house out of loonies. It's going to be a very expensive and not very pleasant house to live in. You can't do that. So, the only reason that currency has any value is we've learned that you can exchange it for stuff that really does have some primary value to you. That's it. It's a generalized, and you can get food, you can get water, you can get shelter, you can get all of these things with money. Okay? So money is an excellent example of a generalized secondary reinforcer. In terms of primaries, we talk about things like food if you're hungry, water, fluids if you're thirsty, heat, shelter if you're cold, these sorts of things. But ultimately, things, you know, as they so often do with anything in psychology, get way down to the brain. So ultimately, when we look at the neurobiology of reinforcement, we're dealing with dopamine, right? So we can talk about the pleasure centers of the brain, or it's also called the reward pathway. And there's been lots of studies that involve electrical stimulation of the brain, stick an electrode into a rat or a person's brain, jolt, and it's like, ha, 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 I feel good. Okay, rats will actually starve themselves to death if they can press a lever that will give little electrical jolts into the pleasure center of the brain. It's like they just keep having one little rat orgasm after another, and they don't even press the lever to get food. So very, very addictive. What's involved here is dopamine. So dopamine is one of your, as you undoubtedly know, major neurotransmitters here. And dopamine is released when, at least within mammals and avians, at least it gets released by the brain when, because of appetitive stimuli. Both primary and secondary reinforcers produce this. What's interesting about the dopamine is that different amounts of dopamine will get released depending on various circumstances. The amount of the reinforcer. Give a little bit of food if you're hungry, a little bit of dopamine. More food, more dopamine. Okay. A very intriguing one is the expectedness of the reinforcement being delivered. So surprise reinforcers actually produced more dopamine release than expected reinforcers. So that surprise party actually is more appetitive to you than the expected birthday party. I mean, assuming that the birthday party is actually something that's appetitive. Thank you for reminding me that I'm old, you horrible, horrible people. I hate you all. But assuming that you're actually, you know, going to treat having a birthday party as appetitive, but that surprise. The unexpectedness of something will release more dopamine. If we step back to classical conditioning, we can see a parallel to this. Think back to our Scorla-Wagner equation that dealt with running. On every acquisition trial, you acquire a bit more, but it's a little bit less than the trial before. So think about it this way. With every learning trial, some dopamine is released, but after with each learning trial, what you're experiencing is more expected. It's less unexpected, less surprising, and so less and less and less dopamine gets released on each particular trial. So go, yes, another rat pellet. I'll eat it, but... Okay. So the more you've learned, the less surprising coming up with a new little bit of learning is. It's less reinforcing. One of the things we get into as a byproduct of this are our addictions. And we've talked a little bit about various issues of addiction before. We talked about Siegel's work with contextual stimuli and classical conditioning, and overdoses and whatnot. We see some interesting things with respect to both internally produced drugs, so your endorphin system, dopamine, and external drugs. So orgasm produces your own opiates, or you can bring them in externally. There's cocaine, there's crack, all kinds of lovely little things that can be pumped into your body that do horrible things to you over the long term. Dopamine is stunningly addictive. Okay? I'm slightly surprised that nobody has started trying to sell dopamine on the street. Just take this hit of dopamine. It's going to be great. You have to sort of shunt it into your brain, which I guess is probably a little bit of a problem there. But once neural shunts become, more accepted, what's that? It's my neural shunt. I can bump dopamine straight into my pleasure centers. Wow, sweet. Yeah, okay. Cyberpunk going on here. But dopamine is a stunningly addictive, naturally produced drug by your body. Dopamine converts, as a breakdown process, converts into epinephrine, as adrenaline. So the concept of thrill junkies or extreme sports, this sort of thing, you develop tolerance to your dopamine. So if jumping out of an airplane produces a certain amount of dopamine rush, look, two things. You're going to develop some tolerance to this, which is one thing. Go back to Siegel's work. Two, with each time you do the jumping out of the plane, it's less surprising, it's less unexpected, so less dopamine is being released. To get the same rush from the dopamine, you have to do something more extreme. Initially, just jumping on the airplane was, pretty exciting, released a lot of dopamine. Then, it's no good. You have to jump out of the airplane carrying something. I don't know. Riding a bicycle, something like that. You see this, or a skateboard, or a surfboard, or something. And that's still not enough. So you need to be riding your snowboard out of the airplane while carrying a goat. The goat's probably getting a massive dopamine surge here. It's like, punch it! So thrill junkie goats. It's great, man, let's do it again. But it's, you need to start carrying larger farm animals, cows. It would have been the same sort of rush. Pretty soon it's like, maybe I don't need my backup parachute. Maybe you don't need your main parachute. Got a goat and a snowboard, what could go wrong? Lots, probably, but anyways. The runner's high, marathon runners get addicted to running. They're doing massively, running 26 miles in all at once as fast as you can is kind of, do you know what happened to the first guy that, from the story, that ran the marathon? This was the Greeks fought a big battle, and it's like, go back, run to the town of Marathon and tell them the results. This guy runs 26 miles to tell them the results. We won! And then he died. He dropped dead outside the gates of the town of Marathon. He's like, victory! Because the run killed him. So, marathons. It's like, I run marathons every week. Okay, that is insane. I just can't stop. It's like the pressure on your knees, your lower back, all of you. This is, humans weren't really designed to do this. There's no problem. I just can't and won't. But, other people, it's fine. They're good at it. That's wonderful. That's terrific. I have no problem with people, doing their own things. But, you know, it becomes addictive. Marathon runners, no, they're blowing their knees out. They're doing permanent damage to their ankles. And they keep doing it. If I could just find a better shoe, that'll fix it. It's like, yeah, that's one possibility. Or you could stop. I just can't stop. Dopamine. It's addictive. Okay. So, all kinds of cool things with that. And so, I mean, people that do neurobiology, neuropsych, right? You go, oh, neuropsych, that's not really the learning stuff, is it? It's like, yeah, there's a connection in there with the cool addictive stuff. Really neat connection back to the learning psychology. Okay, so various types of reinforcers there. Gonna just shift here a little bit. So one of the reasons that perhaps this is an odd thing. I mean, your textbook starts you with like some background, goes into some kind of, you know, innate stuff and some basic learning, and then it goes into classical conditioning, and then we get into eventually the operant. Every textbook I've ever seen does it in that sequence. And I find it weird because, frankly, most people are, by the time they get to this class, they already have experienced and they get operant learning more than classical, right? I mean, probably some idea of classical. But, I mean, you've trained a dog. You, too, were trained through operant. Conditioning. If you can use a toilet successfully, you too have been operantly conditioned by somebody in the past, your parents, your nurse, a sibling, somebody has to use the toilet. That's operant conditioning. You all have experienced it yourself, and you have probably done it on some other critter, be it non-human or human. And one of the reasons for this, you may have even conditioned yourself to do things, is that operant conditioning has this massive strength. You can condition, practically speaking, any behavior. Okay, practically anything out there that might involve a response that you are going to perform in the environment can be acquired through operant learning. In the case of classical or Pavlovian, you're limited to things that involve reflex action. At root. Somehow you've got to get back to that reflex. So classical conditioning is pretty much useless for teaching you how to program your DVD to record shows. Is the little light on the DVD player on? Yes, you get a cookie. You're salivating. It's like, great, I just drooled all over it and shorted it out. That's lovely. So now I salivate when I see my DVD recorder. I still don't know how to program it. Okay, operant conditioning, you can be taught how to program. Well, maybe not my mom, but in theory, you could be taught how to program this. So that's a real strength. Now, the way that this is done is to use what's called a technique that's called shaping. And this was another sort of big shift from the work of Thorndike and his contemporaries at like the beginning of the 20th century to Skinner and his contemporaries by, say, the late 1930s, is there's this shift from just studying the trial and error kind of operant learning to, we'd really like to figure out how to get non-human animals and people to do this specific thing in a particular way. Now, of course, people had already been doing this for hundreds, thousands of years, but this is where the study of it sort of comes in. And Skinner formalized a technique that he called shaping, or more, so the more technical term is successive approximations. So you saw a little bit in the video there, if the pigeon like turned its head one direction, bleep, Skinner would give it a little bit of food. He's just waiting. For the first time, he's just waiting for the pigeon to do it by just accident. For whatever reason, the pigeon like looks over there, and Skinner goes, yep, that's it, boom, gives it some food. You know, the pigeon looks someplace else, nothing. The pigeon looks back the other, boom, give it some food. Pigeon's not, I mean, you know, it's a bird brain, but it's not completely stupid. It's like, I like the food. It's like, what was that? Boom, give it some food. But you don't just want the pigeon, Skinner doesn't want the pigeon just to look to the left. He wants the pigeon to make a complete circle. So now what he starts to do is he no longer just gives it food for looking a bit to the left. He's got to look further to the left. So if it only looks a little bit to the left, nothing. Further to the left, boom, food. You do this for a while. If the pigeon stops looking, you know, far to the left, you go back, you backtrack a little bit, just when it looks left, you give it some more, then you step it up again, you move to the next level. Take it to the next level. That's the successive approximations. So looking to the left a little bit is an approximation of turning in a circle to the left. It goes a little bit more. It looks a little bit further. You give it some food. It sort of takes a little step around there. It's not all the way. You give it some food. And then you only give it food if it makes the complete circuit. Okay, so that would be in the successive approximation of getting a pigeon to turn to the left. A shaping protocol. You can do it with a lever, with a rat, right? Pretend this little table bench over here is the lever, and I am the rat. Possibly easy to imagine. Or a plump rat, but a gradual process, right? So the rat looks at the lever, boom, human operator, gives it some food. The rat takes a step towards the lever, boom, give it some food. If the rat stops taking a step towards the lever, it won't move now. It's like back down, back up, go back a step. Just give it some food when it looks at the lever. Okay, so it's now moving towards the lever, gives it food. Now it has to come right up to the lever before we give it any food. Now it has to touch the lever. Now maybe we don't care how it touches it. Maybe it touches it with its nose. Maybe it's with paws. Maybe it just kind of leans on it. Whatever it is, that's the first step. Then we want it to do it with its paws. So now just leaning against the lever doesn't do it. It has to touch the lever with its paws. Okay, and maybe we really want it to do it with its left paw so we could even get more specific. It's like, hey, right paw, no good, has to be left paw, okay. And then the beauty of the lever is eventually the pressing the lever itself will actually activate the food dispenser. Okay. So it's a gradual process. There's a feedback system involved. They're doing something that is closer to the finished product. Reinforcement is delivered. But it has to keep getting closer. It keeps getting... not necessarily harder. I mean, looking to the lever isn't that much harder than stepping up to it, but you got to keep making it closer and closer to the final thing that you want. If anyone that has ever taught anything to kids, right? I mean, learning an alphabet, writing letters, doing martial arts, it's like, you know, ever watch, like, you know, little kids doing taekwondo or something, right? I mean... they kick and fall over, and right? But the instructor's like, excellent! You know, it's like, yeah, in a fight, dropping yourself to the ground is going to be a terrific way of self-defense. But hey, it's a beginning point. And then gradually you work them up for better and better form. So it's, again, shaping. Now, one of the things we saw in that little video was saying that you can condition some very elaborate behavior responses. These are often called response chains. So it's not just press the lever, but it's going to be, you have to do like maybe a series of behaviors in sequence. Now each behavior, so we call it a chain, right? Like each behavior is a link in the chain. Now each link will have its own shaping process involved. Once you complete one of the links, you then move to the next one, and the next one, and the next one, so until you've got the whole sequence of behavior done. The ultimate objective is going to be the primary reinforcer. You're doing this ultimately to get your primary reinforcer. Along the way, there will be conditioned reinforcers. And, of course, there's going to be various discriminative stimuli. So, different ways you can do this. You can do either what's called backwards chaining or forwards chaining. Let's start by talking about backwards chaining here. Backwards chaining is more often... it's a technique more often used when doing, we'll call it complex training. It's a whole series of things that have to be done in a very specific way. Because of this, what we often do in backwards chaining is start with the last response in the chain, or the last link in the chain. Once we've got that going, we then move, I guess you'd say backwards, and you do the second last response, which then feeds into the last response. Once you've got the last, you know, the second last and the last being done successively, then you go back and it's like, okay, here's the third last response in the chain, third link, second link, then to the end link, and so on and so on. So you start with the primary reinforcer. So you do the last link, you get the primary. do the second last link. You don't get the primary yet. You have to complete the last link before you get the primary. So completing the second last gives you a conditioned reinforcer, says you're closer now to the primary, and so on. Here's an example. Let's say you decide to give up on academia, take what you know about reinforcement theory, and go off and start your own rodent circus. Okay, so you've come up with this idea that people will pay money, not in this economy, but people will pay money to watch a rat walk up a ladder to a platform, go across a little tightrope onto a second platform, and then down the ladder to get some cheese. 10 years ago, maybe. Okay. As we all know, the international symbol from the Bonn Accord of 1973 is a piece of cheese, is represented by a small orangey-yellow triangle. I'm making that up. There is no Bonn Accord of 1973. I wish there was. That would be cool. But no. So I'm just using a little sort of yellow triangle here to represent cheese. We'll call this cheese here for a hungry rat, the primary reinforcer. Am I concerned that the rat's going to have cardiac disease from eating too many fatty foods? No, not really. It's not actually a real rat. It's a little picture of a rat. So here's going to be our primary reinforcer. Okay, at the end of this, remember, we want the rat to go up the first ladder, across the tightrope, down the second ladder to get to the cheese. Let's pretend that's a rat, okay? Just work with me. Fine. There's my little stick rat. Stick people, I've got stick rats. We started on our second platform, so we're going to do backwards chaining. Okay, I'm just going to put it on the second platform. Looks down the ladder, there's the piece of cheese. All right. Now, this point here, our second platform, let's call this a discriminative, this is a discriminative stimulus. Okay? If you are on this platform, what response should you make to get the cheese? Climb down the ladder. So three-term contingency. In the presence of the platform, go down the ladder, there's your response. Outcome, you get the cheese. Okay? Discriminative stimulus, response, outcome. So this is the first discriminative stimulus that I've exposed our rat to, and the first response that it's been exposed to is climbing down, and there it gets the outcome, the cheese. Now, we want to do more than this, so now, once it's got that going well, we're going to move it to our first platform. Move it over here. All right, now, this platform is it's another discriminative stimulus. Let's call it discriminative stimulus 2, because it's the second one that we've presented to it. And this response that it needs to make now is it needs to walk across the tightrope. So we'll call that response 2. So second response we're training here. Now, by going across the tightrope here, it gets to this platform. I've already described this platform as a discriminative stimulus. But once we add in the second link in the chain, this platform becomes a secondary reinforcer. It becomes a secondary reinforcer for its response. In the presence of the discriminative stimulus, this platform, make the response going across to this next platform. Now the cheese is way over there. But by getting to this platform, you are that much closer to the cheese. This platform serves as a reinforcer. You're partway there. It's kind of like if you're studying for an exam. You get through a chapter in your textbook, you're not done yet, but you are partway there. There's a little bit of, it's like, okay, on I go. What's the next thing you do? Well, you're now on this platform. This platform has become a secondary reinforcer for this response of walking across the tightrope, but it's also still a discriminative stimulus for the next response, which is going down the ladder to get the primary, to get the primary reinforcer. We're then going to move our little rat down to the bottom here of the first ladder. So at this point now, our first ladder becomes another discriminative stimulus, the third one we're going to train it with. It's going to have to make another response, climb up the ladder, get to this platform. This platform becomes a secondary reinforcer for this link in the chain. in the presence of the ladder, looking up the ladder, the response you make is to climb up. You get to this platform. It's a secondary reinforcer. Okay? Now, so it's a secondary reinforcer for this third link here. That's why I call it secondary reinforcer three. Not that it's the third one that you've encountered, but it's part of this link. This platform, then, is a secondary reinforcer for this link. It's also the discriminative stimulus for the next thing. Walk across the tightrope. This platform then becomes a secondary reinforcer for that link and the discriminative stimulus for the last response to go down, and then you get the primary reinforcer. So part of the reason why some people like using backwards chaining on this is you start with the primary reinforcer. It is always going to be at the same place. If you were to do forward chaining with this, you'd start with your rat here, and you'd put the cheese up there. So it would go up and get the cheese. Then you'd have to move the cheese over to here. And some people just don't like doing that because they think, oh, the rat's expecting the cheese here, but now it's further on, so now it gets frustrated, da 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 da. So, and sometimes that happens. Sometimes just a personal preference. Sometimes it does seem that if you're doing, I mean, three isn't that many steps here, but if you're doing something that may have 12 or 15 steps in the process, there is some evidence that maybe running it backwards is going to be more effective there. Okay, so like I said, forward chaining, same basic idea, except you start at the first link in the chain, and you just keep moving your primary reinforcer a little bit further away, one link further on. Okay, so you keep adding. But by doing this, I mean, it doesn't have to be silly things with rats going up ladders and tightropes and whatnot. It could be the programming the DVD. It could be learning some driving technique. It could be anything. Anything at all that involves multiple steps, multiple behaviors. All right. There are, much like in classical conditioning, a variety of factors that are involved in operant conditioning, operant learning, and many of these will be somewhat familiar at this point. There is a certain parallel between the types of learning that we have discussed. So, contiguity. Remember, technically contiguity is the time and or distance between two events. Again, when we're doing operant learning, generally distance is not a big sort of thing. Usually your subject is going to be very close, in very close proximity to your discriminative stimulus, your response, and your outcome. So usually, again, what we're talking about here is the temporal separation. And in this case, whereas in classical conditioning, we're talking about the temporal separation between the CS and the US, here we tend to be talking about the temporal separation between the performance of the response and the delivery of the outcome. So like I said, if the dog runs across the field to bring back the Frisbee and it doesn't get the meaty treat until it gets back to me, what's it making the association with? Well, me and the meaty treat. What I'd really like it to do is get the association of, you know, going to get the Frisbee, picking up the Frisbee when it's way away, that's what I want it to do. I don't want it just to run out there, go, yep, found the Frisbee, and run back without it. Whereas, so the secondary reinforcer, as soon as it gets the Frisbee, tweet, on the whistle, great, score. Close, you know, very short contiguity there. Okay. So delays. If you delay, if there's a delay between the response and the outcome, this can let other behaviors occur. Forgetting starts to come in. We'll talk about forgetting later in the course, but forgetting comes in. There could be extinction. If from the subject's point of view, it's been such a long delay that there hasn't been an outcome, well, the response without the outcome, that's extinction in operant conditioning. So conditioned reinforcers can often serve as a placeholder for things, that sort of stuff. But there's other things that can. So, you know, ever phoned up, whatever, tech support or customer service or something, right? And it's like, hi, I need to, can you hold, please? No, I click. Guess I'm going to be holding, aren't I? Hello? Any? Did they just hang up on me? I don't want to hang up. What's the nature of your aisle? Right? You don't know if they're coming back. Really simple thing that can be done. Put a placeholder in, you know, periodically. Your call is important to us and will be answered in the order that has been received. Now, that's okay, but it would be better if your call is important to us and will be answered in the order received. You are 14th in line. Your call is important to us and will be answered in the order it has been received. You are 6th in line. Okay, so letting you, this is actually getting better, right? I'm getting closer. All right, stay on the phone. Okay, so placeholders can be very, very, very useful with respect to this. Violations of contiguity are massively significant with respect to the delivery of punishers, the delivery of aversive outcomes. Okay. They're important for the delivery of appetitive outcomes, reinforcement, but look, people want the appetitive outcome, right? So if a kid cleans the room, it's like they will make sure they tell their parents. Like, Did you see it? Can you wait a few minutes? Mommy's busy doing something right now, or Daddy's busy. So, but I have okay. Can you just give me a minute? It's like, okay. I really want to tell you something. He's like, they will. It's like, okay, look, I just need two minutes. I'm making a nuclear bomb. Okay. 2 minutes. You're not really making a nuclear bomb, Dad. I know, I wish. Okay, second, what is it? It's like, I'm cleaning my room. Oh, that's terrific. Good for you. Okay, they will let you know. Right? Maybe this has happened to you or someone you know. You know, think back to, well, you probably won't remember, but you know, imagine you got like a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old or something like that. Or you know, even, you know, my cousin who's an adult now, right? You know, does something wrong, like, you know, the little kid, you know, draws on the, you know, 8 in the morning, draws on the wall with, you know, permanent marker. You know, I'm going to try to be inclusive, so parental caregiver number one, not mommy or daddy, because who knows who's out working, who's not, or even what the marital relationship is. So parental caregiver number one goes, just you wait till parental caregiver number two gets home this evening. Then you're gonna be in trouble. Parental, 8 hours pass. Parental caregiver number two comes home. It's like, oh, you know, what a day. Or, oh, what a day. Okay, again, not making judgments here. All right, you know, it's like, and you're the other parental caregiver one. Your child, my child. Parental caregiver number two. Did you draw on the wall with permanent marker this morning? What wall? The wall right here! When? This morning! No? Don't lie to me! 8 hours! The kid can't remember! About 8 hours for a small child is like 12 years for you. If you are parental caregiver number one, don't say wait for parental caregiver number two to get home. Just punish the child right away. Do it immediately. It doesn't have to be cutting their hands off, right? It's like, fine, you know, here's the bucket of soap, here's the sponge, you scrub. You know, or it's like, time out for you. I'm putting your crayons or your permanent markers up really high. It's like, why did you give them to me anyways, parental caregiver number one? I don't know, because I was stupid. As we've learned, we're getting rid of all permanent markers in our house. Yeah. My 2-year-olds found them. So it's like, don't delay the punisher. You know, anyone tried to housebreak a puppy? Right? You go away for the day, you know, you come, well, the puppy comes running over to see you. The puppy's excited. It's like, and like there's a pile of poo and pee on your floor, and you freak out. It's like, oh, bad puppy. Well, his face in it. What have you just taught the dog? Taught the dog that when he comes running over to see you and it's happy, you're going to stick its face in crap. I don't know, my dog just doesn't like me. Yeah, do you think? He probably pooped like 12 minutes after you left. I mean, it's like, oh, I'm nervous and alone in the house. Doesn't remember. It's like, was that mine? Ah. Okay, punish immediately. Do not delay. This is one of the major things that people get wrong when applying punishers. They don't do them right away. Reinforce is not that big of a thing. I mean, ideally, you want to close together, but if there's a delay in there, this is survival. Contingency. Okay, contingency. This is just the correlation here between your behavior and your outcome. Well, if you've got a strong, you do this response, bam, there's the outcome. It is consistent. Presence of stimulus to make this response, boom, that is the outcome. If you are consistent in things, learning is straightforward. It will be easier. I'm not saying easy, but it will be easier. If there is a consistent pattern, a rule, a contingency, you can get that. What if it's random? Sometimes when I do this behavior, I get punished. Sometimes when I do this behavior, I get reinforced. Or, I should say, sometimes when I do this behavior, something aversive happens. Sometimes something impeditive happens. Sometimes nothing really seems to happen whatsoever. What the heck am I supposed to do? I don't know. It's random. What behavior? So this applies for both reinforcement and punishment. Be consistent. If you don't want your kid leaving toys all over the house, if it's like, fine, you have to clean up your toys before bed, do it every night. Not like, oh, guys, I'm just too tired to force my kid to do this tonight. What's the kid learning? Sometimes I don't have to do it. Sometimes I leave the toys out and, the parent trips over something, so cleans it up for me. It's not being bad. The kid's just not having a consistent contingency there. Okay? Consistency. That's another one that's important there. Outcome characteristics here. Generally speaking, the larger the reinforcer, the larger the punisher, the stronger the learning is going to be. Keep in mind, this is not a linear effect. A moderately sized punisher probably lead to fairly suppressive results. A somewhat stronger punisher will probably lead to a faster decrease in the behavior. A really strong punisher may just leave a smoking crater on the floor that was a person. And that is too strong. So nonlinear. Reinforcement, right? For kids, it's like, okay, you did your chores, here's your allowance of a dollar. It's like, oh, you did your chores, here's your weekly allowance of $5. You did your chores. I've just put $6 million into your bank account. You're probably going to get more motivation to do the chores with the $5 over the $1. But, once you've gone to $6 million, what is the kid supposed to do? It's like, I just bought Lego. You mean you bought some sets? No, I bought Lego, the company. It's like, at that point, it just becomes kind of ludicrous. So it's not going to be a linear progression. Think of it as sort of like low amounts, ordering some more, good. At some point, it's not going to keep scaling. At some point, you will just asymptotically max out. All right? So if you reinforce yourself with getting through a chapter by giving yourself a cookie or something, right? Cookie. But if you, it's like, okay, I get through the chapter, give myself 3 cookies, right? Get through the chapter. I'll be even more motivated if I eat like a whole box of Mr. Christie's. It's like, now I feel sick. Okay, so it's not going to be linear. All right? Okay. We'll come back to this next class. All right. So we'll see you on Thursday, and we'll wrap this stuff up. If you still haven't picked up your first assignment, got those. If I still need your second assignment, please bring that on up to me.